8 on the agenda, the Profanity Peak Pack Update Briefing. So Dr. Donnie, it's your show. My pheasant guide.
Yes, I have some helpers here.
Write that down.
Thank you, Chair Smith, members of the commission, Director Unsworth. Good afternoon. Here to talk about the final report for the Profanity Peak Wolf Pack. As folks know, this year we exercised our lethal removal in that pack, and a part of the protocol that we developed in conjunction with our Wolf Advisory Group this last, in 2016, the first half of 2016, one of the elements in that is that after the Department of Fish and Wildlife exercises lethal removal, that we provide a full report of that at the end of the year. And so that's what this is. Also, this is a PowerPoint presentation, obviously. The final report is also online. We put it online late yesterday, and I provided a copy of the report to you, and there are also copies of the presentation and this report for the public out on the table outside. And there is an appendix that's not attached to this. There's about 180 pages of depredation investigation reports. And if you'd like to see that, those you can jump online and download those. But I didn't want to waste too many trees here today. So get started with this. I got with me Joey McKenna, the Private Lands and Wildlife Conflict Supervisor, that was working on this removal project and up in that area, and Trent Rosine, who's the wolf biologist and also is up in the call area. Both are locals in that community up where the Profanity Peak Wolf Pack is. So real quickly, I know this is a review for all of you, but for folks that have seen it, this is the first time. Just a reminder that wolves in Washington are state-listed throughout the state. In the western two-thirds, that they are federally listed under federal ESA. We have a wolf conservation management plan that was adopted by the commission in 2011. And real quickly here, the recovery objectives for wolves in Washington. Wolves are, by the way, naturally colonizing Washington. They are expanding from the east in Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and expanding into eastern Washington and moving westward. In our recovery plan, it designates that for delisting, considering delisting at 15 successful breeding pairs for 3 consecutive years, and a reminder of a successful breeding pair, that is a breeding pair of wolves that produces pups, and at least 2 of those pups survive until the end of December, then it just reaches that benchmark for us as a successful breeding pair. Or 18 successful breeding pair in 1 year rather than 15 in 3 years. In each of those cases, those breeding pairs have to be distributed amongst the 3 recovery regions that you see on the screen. And real quickly, based on some modeling and the trajectory of the population that we're seeing to date, we may be getting close to these recovery objectives by as soon as 2021, plus or minus a year or two. Again, a little bit of review here. We had our first pack in 2008, and that is the lookout pack that's kind of centered here in the screen. That was our first pack that we got in 2008. As of this last June, we had 19 packs. 16 of those were in the eastern recovery area that you see on the right-hand side of the screen here. This is the part of the state that is federal, that is not listed under federal ESA, and where the department has full management authority, and where we have the authority to remove wolves if necessary for conflict with livestock. In this remainder of the state, these 2 recovery areas, wolves are federally listed under ESA, so we do not have that authority to remove wolves, and the entire state is state listed. And to point out Profanity Pack, to put you on the map here, here's the Profanity Peak Pack, and we'll be this report will focus on that pack and the lethal removal action that we took this year. Also a reminder, each year we do a series of surveys once the snow hits the ground to estimate how many wolves we have in the state. This gentleman here to my left does a big chunk of that. It's a lot of work in a fixed-wing aircraft or on a snowmobile or snowshoes out there looking for wolves, counting tracks, seeing them from the air, so that at the end of each year in December, we have a final count for how many, the minimum number of wolves we have in the state. And sometimes that occurs and can stretch into January and early February as well, taking advantage of the snow. And this last year, at the end of the 2015 year, our count was 90. That's a minimum. There's more than 90. And there's more packs on the landscape than we detect. So we're always, as wolves are continuing to colonize, their population is growing and growing and growing. And we'll talk about that in a moment. Here's the list of which packs in the, at the end of 2015 in the state met the successful breeding pair definition. And then just wanted to call out profanity here, that as we were going into the 2016 grazing season, our best estimate of the size of the Profanity Peak pack, these gentlemen will be talking about that in a moment, was 7 individuals, and that's a minimum estimate. As you'll hear, the number was actually larger than that because we don't see all the wolves on the landscape.
To clarify then, this minimum number is for which year?
So the, let me describe it a little different way. So the estimate for the end of December 2016 will be coming out anytime soon, within a month. So this was the estimate for December, the end of December 2015. And we'll be presenting to you in March the updated numbers from the surveys that we're completing right now.
Yes. Exactly what is counted? Do you actually have to see an animal or tracks?
I'm going to pass this to the right guy.
Yeah, thanks, Trent.
Thanks, Commissioner Thorburn. So in packs that have collars, we're actually counting animals that we have seen on the ground or from the air. In packs that are uncollared, we do it with tracks in addition to cameras. So if we see tracks, we need to confirm that with camera work, and then we'll get counts that way on uncollared packs.
Thank you.
Trail cameras.
Yeah, trail cameras.
So here real quickly is a snapshot of the trend in that number, the minimum estimated number of wolves in Washington. And as you can see, it's increasing. What we're seeing is from 2008 when we documented our first pack, confirmed pack in Washington, until December of 2015. On average, it's about a 30% increase per year. And I wanted just to put that out there, that's the increase that we're seeing, that is a combination of both continuing to get wolves from neighboring states, but also our own wolf population expanding and production of pups and et cetera. And then also tied to that, that one of the analysis that we did in our wolf plan and a later manuscript that was published is what we're talking about today and the removal and the numbers of wolves are removed is not an impact on this growth rate. We're seeing wolf population, a healthy wolf population, continue to expand. And so the numbers you'll be hearing about today are not ones that are jeopardizing recovery. And then another look at the data, slightly different. This one in gray is the number of packs, as you can see, increasing. And in the dark black, the number of packs that are depredating. And so one of the things you've heard us say and me say before is that on average, about 80% of the packs coexist with livestock just fine. We don't have problems. And about 20% of the time, we do see conflict. And that's an average that's been out there for decades and kind of built on early data from colonizing populations in other Western states. And we're seeing that level or a little less, and it just depends on the year. Switching gears a little bit, as you know, wolf management can be controversial. And each year we present to you the progress that we're doing in the carrying out the objectives in the conservation and management plan for wolves. Because it's so controversial, one of the things that we have done in the past and continue to build on is working with stakeholders. And we have, as you know, a wolf advisor group. It's a collection, a very diverse collection of folks that have been engaged in wolf management and are aware of the issues, an opportunity to come together and roll up their sleeves and are dedicated to working on some really tough issues and trying to find, instead of continuing to be at war on some of these things, trying to find some cohesion and give some advice to the department. So it's an advisor group that gives recommendations to the department, and I wanted to touch on a couple of their products because the protocol, as you know, is one of those. So over, we've had a wolf advisory group for a number of years. A couple years ago, we expanded that group, and it's the one that you're familiar with now. Here's a couple of the products that they've been working on over the years. This one's the Damage Prevention Cooperative Agreement. It is a cost share program that we have with producers, where we are helping them through cost share to put proactive, non-lethal deterrent measures on the landscape. And here's a, I'm not going to go through this list, but here's a list of some of those things. Because we, in Washington, if we can prevent the conflict from occurring, that's the best strategy to be on. Per the protocol that I'll talk about in a minute, consider lethal removal if the non-lethal tools are ineffective. So this is one of the products that that the Wolf Advisor Group, referred to as WAG, has been working on. And over this last 16, 18 months or so, one of the additions they made to that is actually documenting the expectations of those non-lethal deterrence measures and what really that means on the landscape. They've also picked up from the original Wolf Advisor Group a few years ago what the department refers to as our non-lethal checklist. This is something we visit with livestock producers. We visit with, or as we interact with that producer and look at their operation and say, what do you think would be good in terms of preventative measures in your operation, and work through this checklist and try to get those things in place. And this was without cost share dollars. And then the last product and most recent one is the completion of the protocol for consideration implementation of lethal removal of wolves during recovery to stop depredations. This was a major lift for a diverse group of stakeholders. They worked very hard on this with the department. It was co-developed with many of our staff and the diversity of stakeholders involved, where they, again, rolled up their sleeves and tried to put something out there that we could start with. It is a work in progress. You've heard me say before, Rome wasn't built in a day. But this is a path for us on how we approach the strategies of non-lethal deterrence and then when we consider lethal removal. And specifically in that, it talks about the criteria in that protocol is that the department would consider lethal removal if there are four or more confirmed depredation events within a calendar year, or six or more over two consecutive years. At least one of those confirmed depredations by wolves was where wolves killed livestock versus injuries. The proactive deterrence measures, and I'm going to talk about those in a moment, have been implemented as we expect and have failed to prevent depredations. So there's this cycle of repeated depredations. That we expect depredations to continue, and that the public has been notified of that there's wolves in that area, and the sequence of events as they've unfolded. It also talks about in the protocol the expectations for deterrence measures, that livestock producers are expected to have proactive deterrence measures on the landscape, one of those plus sanitation, and that they're doing that in concurrence with dialogue with the our wildlife conflict specialist. Those tools must be suited to their operation. It just can't be anything. It has to be a bona fide tool that makes sense for their operation. And if there is a confirmed depredation, and preferably after the first one that happens that we're aware of, that if there is any other reactive deterrence measures that make sense, that we'd communicate that to the producer and that they would implement those as well. So I'm going to switch gears here, and these folks will give you more specific information.
Thanks, Donnie. I want to thank the chair and the commission and director for having me here today. And I'll just give you a brief history on the Profanity Peak Wolf Pack, and I think it highlights kind of the dynamic nature of what we're dealing with here, and kind of how things can get a little more complicated than we'd like them to be. So in the fall of 2014, during the middle of the huckleberry depredations, we actually received a report from a hiker on the Kettle Kest Trail of a dead wolf pup. And when we went up to investigate that pup, we actually determined that there were at least three adults and three more pups in that area. And that was the first time we'd ever heard about wolves in the Kettles, at least north of the Colville Reservation line. So from then, we put cameras up in that area, began monitoring that pack just in that very specific area. And it wasn't too long after that, maybe 2 weeks after we confirmed that PAC existed, that some producers came in and they had reported depredations on livestock. And those are outlined there. On 9/12/2014, we confirmed that the wolves had killed at least one cow and one calf. And on 9/15/2014, we found an injured calf on the landscape as well. So almost immediately from the time we confirmed that PAC, they were involved in livestock depredations. We did try to trap them and put collar into that PAC immediately that year. But because we knew so little about the PAC at that time, we just had one little stretch of trail that was about a mile and a half from the nearest road. We had to backpack all our traps up there and come back and forth every day. We were only trapping on about a 400-yard stretch of trail. We weren't successful in that fall. So throughout that winter, the winter of 2014 and 2015, we continued to monitor that pack via ground tracking. And by the spring of 2015, I had a good enough idea on the pack movements patterns that we were able to get in front of them and catch the breeding female of that pack. And it's worth noting here that where we caught that breeding female, that pack, was actually at least 15 miles north of where the den site was this year. And it was kind of outside of the realm of where we thought that pack had roamed at the time. So in the spring of 2015, we collared that wolf. And because there was a large degree of livestock overlap in that area, she became part of the WSU research project. And she's intensively monitored throughout the summer up until the stick pin fires kind of stopped all research, all activity in that area. After those fires, she actually moved south quite a ways. And at the time, we thought she was just extending her territory. And it wasn't until our aerial counts that we do every year, that we realized she wasn't traveling with the whole pack that we had seen all summer long. But it was just her and another wolf. So we started to investigate, see what was going on, see if there were still wolves up in the Profanity Peak territory. And through ground tracking, again, we were able to determine that there were still several wolves left within that territory. And so since we were back to ground zero, we had no collars in that pack. We had to start all over, ground track them all winter. And by spring, in late May of this year, I had narrowed down their locations enough that I was able to set traps at the beginning of June and catch two wolves. Caught an adult male on June 9th and an adult female on June 12th. And it's, like I said, it's worth noting that where I caught those wolves this summer was over 10, almost 15 miles away from where I'd been trapping last year at the same time frame. So the wolves are using the landscape completely differently. And because they were using the landscape so differently, we didn't really know what they were doing down there. We didn't know if they were denning. We had some suspicions, but we couldn't really confirm it. So for that first month that we had collars out, from June 9th to July 1st, we were only getting two GPS fixes a day. So by July 1st, we'd only had a handful of GPS coordinates that we'd received from the collars. And we were just starting to get a picture that, hey, the wolves are really concentrating in this area.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Stick pin fire was 2014, is that correct?
2015.
Yep. Okay, yep. 2015. You're not showing the burned area in the pack.
Yeah.
What influence would that have had on their movements? And I mean,
yeah,
so smack in the middle of it.
It was. So the stick pin fire burned a significant portion of their territory, and we really didn't know how the wolves would react to that fire, which is when that collared wolf from 2015 moved south, she moved to an unburned area, and we thought that maybe that they were just looking for unburned habitat. That wasn't the case. There were still wolves using the burned landscape. And the reason we didn't include the fires here is we really don't know how fire impacts wolves on a local pack-by-pack scale. In the long term, it may be good for wolves. It increases ungulate densities in some areas, but we really don't know. And we're looking into it with the UW right now and trying to figure out if there's anything there. So when that female moved south, she formed what was called the Sherman Pack, And at the time, it was just, and that's just this spring, it was just two wolves. It was her, that breeding female from Profanity Peak, and another adult male that we happened to catch with the helicopter as well. So this spring, we didn't know who was in Profanity Peak Pack until we caught those wolves, neither of which were breeding animals. One was a yearling female, and one was an adult male, but that's really all we knew. Just want to make sure I didn't forget anything in here. So we throw this map in here, and this map right here, so I put this up here because you may have seen earlier that we had a polygon for the Profanity Peak Pack earlier, the first slide Donnie showed, and that was from the 2014 data. So that's the polygon that female made. Since she left, and since the wolves seem to be using the landscape completely different, this spring, we didn't really know what these wolves were going to do, so we started with the same old circles that we always do. And that's what this is. So that's really all we knew when we started. But we put this on here to show that the allotments, or this territory, falls entirely or almost entirely within the Colville National Forest and is covered, at least 90% of it's covered by grazing allotments. They probably have more cattle overlap than any other pack in the state. So here's one of those maps that we created after the fact. And don't worry about these depredations at the moment. We'll talk about those later. But this just kind of shows what we knew, or the data we were starting to get early in the summer. And so those yellow, those brighter points are kind of hot spots of activity. And then all those little, well, the blue is areas that the wolves don't visit very much. And then those little pink dots are areas where wolves spent a little bit of time, but it's not a huge hotspot, and that's probably those adult collared animals going out hunting, finding something, bringing them back. Going out hunting, finding something, bringing them back. But like I was saying earlier, at the time, we were not really sure what this was going to turn out to be. That's where I caught the wolves, and this is actually probably weighted a little heavily, because when we catch the wolves, they end up staying in that same area for a couple days. So you get a pile of points, kind of right near where you caught them. So that's what we knew up until about July 8th, and then after that is when the depredation started, and that's where I'll leave it for Joey.
Commissioner's Director. Joey McCann, the Private Lands and Wildlife Conflict Supervisor for Region 1. I was the incident commander for this operation. So I'll start with the producers. We have producers 1 and producer 2. So we know these producers very well. Producer 1 was involved in the wedge pack, the Profanity Peak Pack. One thing that he has done, or that operation has done, is operational changes. So calving earlier, so those calves are going out larger onto the landscape, which is a benefit for the wolves, because the wild ungulates that are out there that are being born, you know, the elk calves and the fawns, are much smaller. So that was one operational change that they did make. So producer two has been working with us. Worked with the WSU collaring study in 2015 and 2016, working with the department as far as the DPCA L contract. Protective range rider out there. June 1, we had 3 range riders out there on his allotment, which is one of the northern allotments, but it's one of the core use areas there. So very familiar with both of these. Okay. So kind of onto the chronology of events, and I just want to make a statement here that our staff, WDFW staff, all that were involved in the investigations this summer are very professional, very well-trained. All of us that were doing those started with the wedge pack, and we've been in the Huckleberry, we've been in Dirty Shirt, so, you know, now this year. So we have a lot of experience, a lot of investigation experience in the field, a lot of learning in 2014 with the wedge, and, you know, kind of learning from that process and moving on. Very good staff out there doing a very good job. July 8th was our first confirmed depredation. So what we do there is we look at kind of what's going on, work with those producers, both the producers, as far as some of the proactive things that are doing, some of the reactive things, for the deterrent measures that they can do. Some of the things we did was increase range riding. So instead of one range rider, we actually had three contract range riders on site, working with producer one as far as getting more of their staff out there, more of their range riders. Human presence was huge out there. Sanitations was huge. And then at that time, our staff time really bumped up in the field as far as the amount of time that our staff was in the field. And I think that's really something that we don't really brag about a lot. But our time in the field was, from that point on, was actually pretty significant. Okay. Okay, and then some of the non-lethals here, you know, to remove or secure the livestock carcasses. So if it's able to be removed from the field, we do that. So a large carcass that's out there, we may not be able to do it, put flattery around it. We had some situations where we had a bear come in and scavenge on it after we put the flattery on it. You know, so go back and check those. So we do those things, and then, you know, cabin or lambing outside of the area that are occupied by wolves is a big one. Producer one actually calves outside of any known wolf territory from Northeast Washington. Producer two, he actually, their operation, they do calve in the area there. We're working with them right now as far as non-lethal deterrence. We have several things on the ground right now, several things lined up to do. So working with them through this whole process, and worked with them last year too. And then turnout, I mentioned that, you know, as far as one of the things is, you know, try to calve earlier, you know, so you can put those animals out on a range at a larger weight. So upon turnout.
Yes.
Who removes the carcasses? Is it the operator or is it our staff?
It's both. So you're out there. It depends on where it's at, how far it's in. Some of these carcasses are maybe 2 miles off any road. They're on a trail. So, you know, if we go to Ashley Flattery out there, but a lot of the times at the end, we have a carcass facility, sanitation at Sherman Creek Wildlife Area. So it'd be a combination of them and us loading into a vehicle. And then it was usually us or them hauling it to that sanitation facility. You know, which is secure in there, then we can lock those up. Then there's a decomposition process that they go through. Okay, I got to get caught up here. Okay, so on July 15th, that was our second confirmed depredation. You know, still have range riders out there working with producers, you know, one and two to increase human presence out there again. So producers were very good on that, you know, very willing to go out, spend more time checking on their cattle, looking for cattle behavior, you know, cattle grouping up into different areas, trying to move cattle. So within an allotment, there may have a grazing plan of four different grazing allotments within one allotment. So earlier in the year, the grazing at a lower operation, then they're moving it to a higher operation as the summer goes on because the grass is greener, you know, as you get higher. Okay. And then on July 23rd was the third documented depredation, and August 3rd confirmed depredations 4 and 5. Okay. So now depredations 4 and 5, so that met our lethal control protocol that we had in place as of June 1 of this year. And so with that determination, we had 5 confirmed wolf depredations for that calendar year event. All 5 were actually killed by wolves, so they weren't injuries at that point. But the proactive deterrence measures that were on the ground and increased did not stop those depredations, so they continued. And we expected them to continue, and then our department notified public as far as the wolf issues that are going on. So at this point, I made a field recommendation to our regional director, and then that was supported by our regional director, and that was passed on to our director from support for our director. At that point, it was a partial pack removal, and it was up to 5 wolves, so a combination of adults and pups in that situation. And we had some different things as far as, you know, 2 adults, 3 pups, 2 and 3, so it was either way. So it was a combination of, you know, what it was. And the whole reason for the partial pack was to reduce the nutritional demand for the size of the pack. So if we brought the nutritional need for that pack value down, then hopefully they wouldn't continue to actually depredate on livestock. Rationale. Rationale for this was, because we wanted to reduce that overall nutritional need for this pack. So if we could do that incrementally and reduce or prevent future depredations, that was our goal. Methods outlined in the protocol. So I have helicopter, we have ground.
Joey?
Yes.
I'm
sorry. Yes.
About the protocol. Can you go back to the slide? number four, is the expectation that depredations are to continue. Can you kind of explain what goes into that kind of process? I mean, how do you make that determination?
So we have livestock that are on the, on the ground. A lot of the proactive deterrence measures that that we feel that are the best suitable for actually both these operators, producer A and producer or one and two. So we're thinking that we're doing everything that's possible out there, and with that, then we're still seeing depredations, and they are still continuing, and we think they will continue.
Okay. Thanks.
Yep. So methods was the helicopter ground trapping and shooting from the ground, and that is our our protocol. This is very rough terrain. If you're not familiar with this area up there, the west side of the crest is fairly open, not as many trees. There's more opportunity there for helicopter work. You get on to the east side of the crest, very heavily timbered, very hard to work by helicopter. Ground operations at that time, were tough, and some trapping, but we did do those things throughout this process, but our helicopter option was our number one. So it really depended on where those animals were. So we were doing a lot of monitoring as far as where these two colored animals are spending their time, so we can call it helicopter in right at the appropriate time. On August 5th, we removed two female wolves, resulting in no additional depredations through August 18th. So at that time, the director... so we ended our lethal removal protocol for that time as far as our action in the field. So as of that evening, then we had stopped actively pursuing wolves to remove wolves. And then on August 19th, we had an additional two confirmed. The director authorized up to full pack removal. I just want to stress in the field as far as up to full pack removal. A lot of local people, local stakeholders, local producers, the public in general, they hear full pack removal. They don't hear the up to. So it's really our messaging, to them as far as what our goal is, and our goal is to stop depredations. In the field, there was a lot of meetings, a lot of conference calls, a lot of late night meetings, as far as explaining what up to meant. And that up to was always left out of there. It was always full pack removal. So it was a huge challenge in the field working with state representatives, commissioners, to explain that it's up to, knowing that this terrain, what it is, and it may not be possible to do that. So that was just, one hurdle to really overcome. And the producers, they got increased frustration. Local representatives did, full pack removal, not hearing the up to, it just really built that, and escalated the situation in the field. Okay.
Bottom there. Recover female.
Yeah, I'm switching to that, yeah. So in late August, four animals were removed. The one adult female was recovered. So on August 21st and 22nd, there was four removed. The 23rd, the ground staff spent extensive time out there using a proximity GPS locations from the helicopters or where that would be. Spent 2 days searching for that animal, could not find that animal. On August 25th, we actually received the GPS flight coordinates and path from the helicopter. So actually on that day, we were able to go out there and actually find that animal. It was very same color as the terrain, so it was very tough to locate, very steep country, you know, very tough to get to. And then upon location of that adult female, she was mortally wounded. She was humanely euthanized, and she was removed from the field on August 25th. Okay, this is kind of one of the emails that we got that came through, you know, to our department. And so this is kind of where I want to stress here a little bit. A lot of people in this room, and I know a lot of the commissioners, a lot of people in this room, actually did not recognize me today when I walked in. So my hair is usually very short, very clean cut, and usually not a beard. So one of the reasons for that is receiving death threats. So we receive death threats, myself, agency staff, WAG members, their organizations. And so this actually became real. So we're in the field. We see vehicles that, you know, they'll stop. They want to talk and see what's going on. They would know my first and last name, and I had no idea who they were. And this happened all summer. I probably had two people that did not know who I was. So as that went on, then it's like, okay, I'm going to start changing my appearance a little bit. We continue to get death threats, some rioting going on, some different things like that. The death threats continue. My last death threat was a week ago Monday on a forum. We work with enforcement on that to find out, you know, where that's coming from, try to chase it down. A lot of these are from other states, maybe even out of the country, you know, but we don't know that. We take it very seriously. I've had people here in the last couple months outside of my house taking pictures of my residence where I live in a small town. You know, and it's come to the point now where my wife and I both sleep with sidearms by our bed, you know, because we have no idea what's going to happen. So we actually take these death threats seriously. So, and it's not just myself, it's other staff members, you know, WAG representatives and stuff. So it's a very serious situation. My mother and father looked at me for Christmas and said I needed a razor and a haircut. And I said, well, you know, not quite yet. So we need to get through this. You know, but it is a very serious situation, as you can see by some of the stuff that we get that come in. And when it's personal, you know, you take it to heart, especially when you have kids and grandkids. August 31st and September 27th, confirmed depredations 8 and 9 were investigated. And then September 29th, there was one adult male was removed. And then October 30th, October 3rd, we had the 10th confirmed depredation event that was investigated. And then at this point, so kind of prior to October 4th through October 14th, what we had is the livestock community, local stakeholders and stuff were, you know, kind of saying maybe we're missing opportunities, you know, so the department staff may be missing opportunities in the field. Or maybe we're not wanting to remove as many wolves as we're saying to, because they're still hearing that full pack and not the up to portion there. You know, but at that time, field operations became critically understaffed. I had two staff members that worked in that district specifically on wolves that actually left the agency for unrelated reasons. So that took that down to myself and one other staff member. You know, so we spent a lot of time on that. So from October 4th to October 14th, so we brought in a contracted trapper to assist with the removal operation with actually no success. And then on October 19th, the director suspended removal action. We had the majority of the livestock off the landscape at that point in time. We had one adult female that was collared and up to three pups. So at that point in time, you know, thought that the potential for more depredations at that time was very low.
And And so we just provided this map to kind of compare with the map earlier in the presentation. It's the same data, but this is what it looks like after a full summer. And by the end of the summer, we did know that there was a den kind of in that central area. You can see all lines kind of coming in and out of there. But I feel like this map really kind of shows really well how vast of an area that these wolves were using. And it kind of helps kind of tell the story of why we weren't able to get in front of these wolves, why that contracted trapper, myself, and the helicopters, why we weren't able to get in front of those wolves. When we trap wolves, they have to be using an area consistently, and you have to have some sort of predictability about it. By the end of this summer, by October, you know, those collared animals were running all over their territory. They're using all parts of their territory. We never knew where they were going to show up next. So when that trapper came in, you know, I was out there with him, and he was asking me what was going on, and I took him out and showed him the lay of the land. And he said, "This is going to be tough. Like, it's just going to be kind of a miracle if we can get something in front of her." And that's basically, you know, it just didn't happen. They're running all over the place. And to be honest, that's part of what lethal control does. I mean, lethal control will change the dynamics of the pack and the behaviors of the pack, and it'll cause them to use their territory differently sometimes. Sometimes that will result in a decrease in depredations, and if that's what we get, then we're done. And at that point, like Joey said, we believe that that small female is no longer able to successfully take down cattle. And along with those cattle being removed from the landscape shortly, we thought that we were pretty safe in calling off the operations.
Almost done here. So in summary,
It just seems to me still that not showing the burn on the maps is something that's missing, because Trey, you said we don't understand the behavior of wolves in burns, and we've thrown in lethal control, but you're saying unusual dispersal. It seems to me that the burn could be a part of that as well. And the reason I'm bringing it up is, can we get some help from our partners in terms of use of the allotments? If you showed the allotments, and if most of that area was burned less than a year ago,
yep,
when the cattle were turned out, you know, in other areas where there are burns managed by other federal agencies, they're not turning out cattle on less than year-old burns. So, and we've got this challenge of not understanding the wolf behavior in a burned area. We're responsible for the wolves, and yet our partners, federal agencies, they don't seem to be helping us at all.
Yeah, and I guess I meant to mention this earlier. So the Forest Service, normally there's 13 grazing allotments that overlap with the Profanity Peak Pack territory. This year, because of the fires, they did rest two of them.
Wow.
Yeah. So two of those allotments were on rest because they were very severely burned. So that fire kind of went through in like a patchy fashion, and it was a 50,000 acre fire, but some areas scorched everything, and some areas it was kind of a patch here and there. But no, I think you have a good point. We don't really know exactly how fire affects wolf behavior. And that's kind of why we're doing this study now, is trying to figure out exactly how wolves react to fire in the near term, in the long term, and further down the road, and see if we can use that information to kind of help inform our management decisions in the future.
Thank you. You said it earlier, but I think I wanted to have you point it out again for everyone in the room that at the time when you were trying to figure out where the profanity pack was hanging out,
yep,
and about the time the first depredations occurred, you really didn't have a good idea at that point where a den site was.
Yeah, I mean, so we had some suspicions. They were using that area with a bit of consistency, but like I said, we were getting two GPS points a day. We really just had, by, you know, October 8th, when the first depredation occurred, the collars had only been on for 31 days. So we just literally had a handful of GPS points, and we weren't confident enough to say that, yes, there's a den here or there's something going on here. We were talking amongst ourselves and our producers and stakeholders, but it wasn't enough to the point where we could say, yes, there's a den here, we need to move on this. And it's a tricky thing when we get a caller on kind of midsummer like that, because we don't have the whole buildup kind of leading up to that.
I'd also just like to point out that, and I've asked for the person doing this WSU livestock, cattle, and wolf interaction study at some point, and she's working up her final dissertation on this right now, to come give us a talk on her study. It's fascinating, and it's going to be very meaningful to as we move ahead and make decisions about all this wolf stuff. Just one picture I saw from the data that we were talking about it one day was eye-opening to me at how much cattle in these type of situations and wolves interact on a daily basis, and nothing ever happens. Occasionally things happen. But just because wolves and livestock are in the same vicinity, in this particular day, a cattle was bedded down, the wolf came through and came within 50 feet of the cow, circled it and moved off and went away. And that goes on daily throughout a whole grazing season with a large number of wolves, a large number of cattle. Yes, then there's ones that get into trouble. But I think it's just good to keep our perspective on this. You know, just because wolves and livestock are in the same general area doesn't mean there's going to be a disaster.
Commissioner Thorburn, I wanted to also follow up on your question. I think it was your comment was a very good one. And some information for the commission and in public is that working with the Forest Service, Forest Service has been at the last several WAG meetings, and there is a common interest there to be preventative. And Joey and I were just visiting today that we're going to be visiting a meeting with the Forest Service here soon in the last WAG meeting, and already talking about trying to that balancing act of when we're aware of where den sites are and when the annual operating plan is out for producers, and can we be in front of that, and so that in real time we're talking about where the risks are in the landscape and are there ways to avoid that. And so it's been encouraging and nice having Forest Service be a part of the WAG and driven wherever it is in the state, and have been now almost a permanent fixture there. And so lots of dialogue coming up very soon, but certainly before turnout this year.
So, and also to add to that also is, so we're seeing from producer one and producer two that they're already working with Forest Service as far as redoing their grazing management plans, as far as to do something different from they did last year. So they're being very proactive at this point already, where these meetings, some of these grazing meetings, don't even take place till March, sometimes April. So those discussions are already happening right now with these producers that were involved last year. So they are making huge strides forward, you know, and wanting to do the right thing. We just didn't have all the information at that point in time. That was in their grazing plan last year, you know, as far as they put cattle. You know, like Trent said, last year was, you know, about 15 miles away where the den site was. You know, fires might have had an impact on that as far as what they did this year. You know, but they are looking at that as what they can do different next year already right now.
Okay, almost done here. Just real quickly in summary, as you've heard Joey describe and what's in the final report, from July 8th until the end of the operation, lethal removal action on the 19th of October, that spanned 15 depredations. 10 of those were confirmed. 5 of those were probable. You can see here on the screen. Majority of those were where wolves had killed livestock. There were 4. There were injuries. The majority were on calves. There was one cow that was from producer number 2. And then, as Joey just described, at the end of the removal action, we had removed 7 wolves. And at that point, October 19th, thought that there was one female with 3 pups, and we're continuing to monitor that closely. Last couple slides here, a little bit on the cost. a big number here, of course. It as we went through this course of this summer, every step of the way, the goal is to stop depredations. We saw, as Joey described it, one step there we thought that we had. On the partial pack phase, depredations continued on again. And so the director authorized up to full pack removal. And throughout the course of the summer, what was very important to us is to carry out the protocol exactly how we had agreed to carry out the protocol. We want to be frugal. We try in every way to be frugal, as Joey just described, you know, calling the helicopter when the wolves are in the open, not calling the helicopter beforehand to have it sit on the pavement while they're in the thick trees and those kinds of steps. And one other item I'd mention here is the transparency is very, very important. Also, want folks to see the dollar spent here. Item that I'd call out is, for example, there you can see here $50,000 for employee salary and benefits, because we wanted to show what it costs. Those folks are charging to that code when they're operating here under this action, which means they're not charging to another code. And so this is not complete expense for the agency, but what it was to carry out this action. Last slide. So for next steps, we're continuing to monitor wolf activity and behavior in this area. In this particular pack, of course, and other packs, but watch this closely. Mm-hmm. Working with other producers in the area. There are other producers beyond these two in this area. And pack territories are very dynamic, so it could shift at any time, as Trent described to you. Joey already talked about coordinating with the producers now, preparing for next year, so we can be one step ahead. We have our next WAG meeting February 1st and 2nd, and then another one scheduled for late March, where we're at the phase now where it's looking back and lessons learned, what worked, what didn't work, where can we make improvements. WAG had acknowledged in department staff that last year was just the first step. It's an adaptive process. We want to improve on the protocol. Coordination on capture opportunities to continue to try to keep collared animals in as many packs as possible. And then we already had a good discussion on the coordination with the Forest Service. And that's all we have. If you have any questions.
Thank you, Donnie, and all of you. And Joey, I'm so terribly sorry about the events and how that one's turning out. That's why I didn't recognize that you, because when you came out, I'm trying to think, okay. Well, I hope you can follow your parents' wisdom soon. My parents told me that for a long time, since I was 18. So
it's not a bad look, though.
No, no. It's kind of a mountain man look.
Yeah, I would just like to take this opportunity while you're here and we're all thinking about this, that the whole concept of the Wolf Conservation Original Plan, you follow. You follow the Wolf Protocol. You know, everything that we knew to be right was done. And yet, would you have any lessons that you feel you've learned from this in terms of, the WAG is going to have to start considering this lethal take protocol again and say, is it correct? Is it set up right? Is there things we could modify? Should we be counting depredations along with, or confirmed depredations? Should we allow something in terms of probable depredations, you know, that occur in a similar pattern or in a similar area that says, things are starting to happen quicker than we thought. Maybe action should be taken quicker than we thought. Maybe, I guess I'm just asking you, are there lessons you pulled out of this that you might be thinking about taking to the WAG for change?
It's a great question. Don't know if I can give you a good answer here. We do. We've met internally, our much larger wolf team, if you will, and we've started having that internal dialogue and preparing for the WAG meetings about some of our reflections. And we've had a good discussion about, as you just talked about, confirmed and maybe the role of probable and how that fits in. And one of the things we continue to talk about is sustainability. We are trying very hard to keep depredations from occurring, and when they do, we're trying, as Joey described, trying very hard to stop depredations, and whether that's through removal or change in the behavior of wolves. And we have wolves in a portion of the state, and they're continuing to colonize in other areas of the state. And how does that look for us to be sustainable in the long run? So those are some of the things we're thinking about. Also, we want to continue the transparency with the public and the updates that we do and all those kinds of things, but those are also sometimes tough on us. We were behind a couple times this year on those, and so how can we continue to provide that transparency and, but, you know, also at the same time keep on task and those things? We have a long laundry list of stuff that we're taking to WAG February 1st and 2nd. We'll have a big portion of our team there to interact with the WAG members. The last thing I'd add is, and I don't know if I'm doing a great job answering your question, but so much of this is not actually the resource issue. Wolf population in Washington is doing quite well. These are tough. We're looking for cohesion on really tough issues, and sometimes it is a social call. It is, where's that balance point when you take all of us as Washingtonians and what we all feel, and you try to find that balance point? And it isn't necessarily always a resource question for us. And so to be able to answer your question, it really takes having all the stakeholders with us, WAG members and many more, and doing that as a team.
Other questions? Yes.
I'm very disturbed that you have to experience the kind of personal concern for your safety that you described so well. That's very upsetting. And I wish you didn't have to, but a couple questions about that. You mentioned that enforcement is going to pursue it aggressively, and I hope they do find the culpable people and prosecute. Kind of like to have a sense if that ever happens and what the punishments, what the penalties are, because I think that word needs to get out. That is not acceptable behavior. But I also just am interested in, because the WAG is the target, too. It's not just staff. It's people who have put themselves in the position of trying to form this group to solve problems, and they're paying a personal price, in a sense. So are there any, will there be discussions with the WAG about how interest groups can try to address this this problem of the fringe kind of extremists who really undercut the value of what the WAG is trying to do and throw fuel on the fire, so to speak? So I don't know if that's a question you can answer, but I suppose the WAG will be talking about, you know, what you all can do.
Yes, so Commissioner, so we, so our internal WOLF group that we're working with, you know, we had a long agenda item, so to go through, and we never made it through it. So we got a lot of things to talk about, you know, a lot of really good discussion on that. And so we kind of tabled some of those things. So we're actually going to be meeting the 30th and 31st for 2 days to continue those discussions before the WAG, so we can prepare everything on our side of it. You know, the enforcement has been absolutely fantastic. Working on a daily basis up there, 7 days a week, is any, you know, vehicle that we saw that, you know, didn't appear to be right. You know, we're on a radio with enforcement. They're running plates for us, getting them back to us. Where are they from? You know, any information, any, you know, criminal history, just anything. A lot of the things, we did have some people that showed up on site, some extremists that were out there. You know, we were warned of that, you know, so we knew who they were, what they looked like, had pictures of them. You know, so we're on high alert in the field. But the enforcement program has been fantastic. Some of these, you know, sites and forums that people are on, you know, their emails are from out of the area. So, I mean, some came back from, you know, from California, from Australia, you know, so, from, you know, from out of the area and stuff. But we did have some that were more local, you know, and stuff. So those are your concerns. People are asking, you know, questions on where's the best vantage point, you know, up on the mountain here. You know, obviously they had heard the helicopter, and, you know, and they want to get video of it. You know, so you kind of put those together. But not just us, but our contracted range riders, too. You know, we had people showing up to our actually contracted range riders' camps, taking pictures of their camp, the people that were working there and stuff, you know. So it's a, you know, it is a concern for us, and we will be addressing this for the future.
Thanks. Other? Yes.
So turning to another subject, you were talking about trying to achieve balance, and the WAG has spent many meetings dealing with producer issues. There's another stakeholder group that sits on the WAG that really, it seems to me, hasn't had a lot of attention, and that's hunters. Is there a plan to bring that into the balance?
Yes, there is. There's a number of priority topics that WAG and the department would like to talk about. And I remember in one of the early WAG meetings here, when our Francine was on board, of that putting all that on the page and then sequencing that. And you know, the protocol, I think, was one of the early ones, because we are already experiencing depredations. We wanted to be able to find that path that is that balance with stakeholder values and with, you know, sustainability with the department. But there are a number of others that WAG will be working on as well. They're aware of that. You brought up one with hunters and impacts on ungulates. There are some things already happening outside of WAG. For example, we're just initiating a large predator-prey project right now. We have folks out getting ready to hang collars on over 100 ungulates in the state and large carnivores to start moving down that path. But WAG has identified that one, as well as, as you saw in the first slide there, that it may be as early as 2021 when we start reaching, getting close to those objectives. And what does wolf management look like beyond that? So the post-delisting one is one that has also come up a number of times.
Thank you. Mr. Carpenter. Donnie, to close out this segment, I just personally want to reach out to you and your staff and thank you for the very hard work and the incredible report that you provided to us. And I'll just want to reiterate a little bit what Miranda and Brad had said. Death threats are totally unacceptable process here. I remember when we had to get escorted a couple years ago by the Highway Patrol and Enforcement, and Director Anderson had received death threats. Totally unacceptable. Thank you very much for your work.
Thank you. Thank you, Commission.
Thank you, gentlemen. And
yes, sir. Commissioner. I want to reiterate that, too, and thank you very much. You guys racked up probably hundreds of hours of extra time this summer each, and I wanted to let you know how much I appreciated it. During the end of the summer, we were running short on staff, and I was calling around, and people we care about in the wildlife community, you guys are top-notch. Thank you.
Thank you, Director.
Good work, guys.
Good work. Thank you. And we're still going pheasant hunting.